Happy Halloween. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najo. We've got a treat for you coming up. We're talking about scary movies. And if you're not sure what that music is, we'll remind you in just a bit. Our guest is Kelly Kirshner. She's here to help us celebrate the holiday. She's an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. She's an associate professor of film, video, animation, and new genres at UW-Milwaukee. What movies have really scared you? What do you want to know about how the filmmakers make us feel afraid? We'll be part of the conversation. Join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Hi, Kelly. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Happy Halloween.
So is this one of your favorite holidays?
It is. I already went to at least one haunted prom already.
Oh, did you? At least. Then there's more in your future.
I do love dressing up, so I do special effects makeup as well, so it's my favorite time of year.
Oh, I'll bet. Yeah, I mean, because sometimes that special effects makeup, it doesn't look like a special effect. It looks very real. That's wonderful.
Exactly.
We just, you know, heard the music from Psycho, in case you all were scratching your head wondering. And I got to tell you, I minored in film in college, and Hitchcock is one of my absolute favorite filmmakers. And I think probably a lot of people think of him as maybe like the father of movies, suspenseful movies like that. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I definitely think that Hitchcock kind of brought, an approach to horror film that was sort of, horror films were B movies, which meant they were sort of second rate and they weren't part of the art of filmmaking. And Hitchcock is the one who sort of brought the horror movie into cinematic sort of history in a way that other filmmakers hadn't. And so that's a very important moment for suspense films. And if we watch Psycho today, of course, it plays out very differently pace-wise and with its jump scares and everything, very different than what we expect from horror today. But Hitchcock's whole approach to suspense was basically to do as much as possible to manipulate the audience's sensibilities. And so, and I think he did that very well.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Psycho was so different. I think one of the favorite things that I've read about it, and hopefully it's true, is that they would not let people come in to the movie in the middle of it like they had done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's part of the mystique also of certain kinds of horror films, where you have not only is the audience controlled in the theater, but also they, you know, as much as you can have them hanging on the edge of their seats. Because one thing about audiences is that we're all very good at decoding certain kinds of genre tropes, you know,
yes.
The things that we expect
yes.
to see. We're good at that. And so when you have the ability to control those expectations and then actually surprise people like Hitchcock did all the time, that's a really important part of the experience. So, he liked to control all sorts of aspects of filmmaking and audience viewing process.
Yeah, very controlling director for sure. Before Hitchcock came out with some of his movies, what was the usual way that horror was used in a film? I'm thinking, you know, I know we can go back all the way to Nosferatu, obviously. How did that change during the different decades of horror?
Well, this is it's a very big question, but I'll try to kind of truncate my answer. But so the thing about the horror genre to begin with is that it looks and tries to play upon the fears and experiences of its audience. And so with Nosferatu and the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, for example, the 1920s films, both of those are responding to, events and elements of the world culturally and socially at the time. It was the time of psychoanalysis coming out, and it was a time of fear of disease and all sorts of other kinds of things that people would be experiencing in their daily lives. After this time period, we go, you know, we could, in America at least, we see the classic Hollywood horror cycle, which includes Frankenstein and Dracula and those films that were coming out in the 1930s. And again, these are escapist fantasies to help people kind of make it through the Great Depression and provide, you know, horrors that are not in your daily world, but sort of far afield. You know, Frankenstein and Dracula were kind of set in a European landscape. So for Americans, it was kind of a departure from their daily lives, whatever that would consist of. And what's interesting about horror in general is that the horror genre rises and falls in popularity as directors sort of oversaturate with certain kinds of monsters or something like that. So if you have Frankenstein and Dracula and the Wolfman who are frightening their viewers and the Mummy, and then you saturate with battles between Frankenstein and the Wolfman and Dracula, and you have all these things that push the horror genre then towards parody and comedy. And so what that means at that point is that directors need to find the new way to kind of get the audiences on the edge of their seat. And what happened in the 1940s is kind of turned inward to psychological horrors with a film like Cat People. And that was another thing that had a supernatural origin in Europe, but it was now placed in America. And then so we have a lot of exploration of psychological themes in the 1940s. At the same time, those classical horror monsters like Frankenstein were still battling it out in you know, their own genre, subgenres. In the 50s, we have, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, in the 50s, we have aliens.
Yeah.
You know, and in the 60s, we get the zombies. And so that kind of brings us almost up to date.
It does. It does. Where would a... like the movie King Kong, how would that fit in?
That fits in with kind of, it's a hybrid genre that was really focused on the ability of the filmmakers and the special effects wizards like O'Brien to create a monster that in our own world that just doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And So yeah, again, it's all based in people's fears. It's the fear of, and in that case, a fear of the other, the fear of the foreign other coming and, you know, taking the innocent, like, you know, woman. And these are tropes. The horror genre is based on these archetypes of villains and, you know, the good guys. And that kind of becomes more complicated as we move towards our time period, because especially with Hitchcock, going back to Hitchcock, Hitchcock was a big fan of the kind of sympathetic killer. So we empathize with you know, Norman Bates, because he was a problem child, right? And then grew up to be a problem adult. But we kind of go from these black and white sort of ideas of good and evil to a very complex idea of how the killer is sort of created by social problems or by society. And so that's why horror becomes a lot more complex after the 1960s, I would say.
So when we talked about Psycho, now that was a black and white movie, and at the time you didn't get a lot of black and white movies. Do you think that black and white movies are scarier in some ways than color movies are?
It's funny. You know, I think that for our sensibilities, when we see black and white, it sort of puts it into a nostalgic mode, and it allows us to kind of, I think a black and white ghost story or a story that's based in more suspense is something that works really well in black and white, and it's still very scary today. But the, you know, when you come around to the Technicolor sort of approaches in the 60s and 70s, where that coincides with the increase of gore and blood, and being able to see that on screen is something that kind of also changes the horror genre. But you look at Night of the Living Dead, that's black and white,
mm-hmm.
and that's still very, very scary.
Right.
It's the way that everything is withheld in that movie. Everything's in just one house, a few rooms, and then you have black and white, just a few characters. And so you really kind of get immersed in this world. So, So I think it just depends on how the the movie's cinematography interacts with either color or black and white.
And we think a lot about, you know, the directors of scary films, but really the cinematographers, lighting people really had a big effect on it, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think some of the ways that horror is delivered is through shadow, the withholding of, you know, whatever's scary just off screen, the withholding of sound or the presence of sound. All sorts of ways that filmmakers are able to manipulate the image, and those are the things that they can show us or take away. And you know, so the typical idea of somebody opening up one side of the fridge, and then when you close it, audiences are at this point expecting to see the killer right there, right behind the door. And that's one of those things. That's a kind of a typical expectation. So you can use it or not. But the cinematographers are thinking a lot about how do you frame an image that we understand that there might be something just off screen.
Because that is certainly important in any movie. And the part of it is not guessing that ahead of time, right?
Right. Or, you know, if you think about it, the best way to kind of get an audience is to give them something they do recognize. And then to play with that and
right.
surprise them despite themselves, right?
So yes.
Yeah.
That's great. What we are talking about scary movies, what makes them so, what we like about them. And our guest is Kelly Krishner. She is she's a artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. We'd love to hear from you. So give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And this is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Just a reminder, if you miss part of our show or maybe want to hear it again, you can always go to our archives at wpr.org/Larry, and you can hear recordings of our broadcasts, and they go way back. Right now, we're talking about scary movies, and Kelly, we've got a lot of callers. So let's go right to Jonah in Little Chute. Go ahead, Jonah.
Hi there. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. What do you want for, what question or comment do you have?
So I'm a big believer in the journey is more important than the destination for horror movies. My favorite kinds of horror movies are the ones that make you wait an obscene amount of time for an actual quote unquote scare to happen.
Sure.
Movies that I think of like this are the first one like this I ever fell in love with was The Witch or The Witch, 2015. Barely anything happens in that movie, and yet it is one of the scariest films I've ever seen because you're constantly on edge. It's amazing the slow pans where you think something's going to be revealed or jump out at you, but it just never happens. And that's not really a spoiler. It's hard to explain how that movie feels. Same with Skinamarink in 2022. Can't recommend it enough. Both of those films and ones like it just tap into the fears inside your mind more than, you know, anything the directors or the effects people could cook up. Your brain is your own worst enemy.
Absolutely. I think Hitchcock was big on that one, too. Thank you, Jonah. Kelly, what do you have to say about that?
Oh, I absolutely agree with The Witch. I think with so many subgenres of horror, you're going to find people making connections with all sorts of different things. But with The Witch, I agree. It's about the mood and about the building of suspicion and tension. And this idea that it taps into some really deep fears that rely on whether or not you're correctly identifying what reality is or not. And that's part of what The Witch is about. It's sort of like, are you believing what's being shown to you, or are you believing the paranoid sort of fantasies of the people surrounding the main character? And so, yeah.
And there's a number of movies like that. What are your thoughts on the Blair Witch Project?
Oh, I liked that. I think I watched it when it first came out, and it was one of those, it was part of a bunch of those handheld sort of genres,
yes.
experiential things. And I think that also helps people kind of be put in the position of, the people who are exploring. I think anytime you have a limitation on the screen or a limitation of sight or environment, it's going to kind of build up the idea of tension. That's why there's a more recent film called The Descent, where it happens underground in these caves. And, you know, the idea of limited ability to see or feel or hear or escape, you know, that all adds up.
That is terrorizing to me because of the thought of being underground. Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's kind of what it does too, right? It finds that certain thing that terrifies you and just keeps popping it and giving it to you.
Yeah, I mean, humans are very good at having a lot of things that we secretly or outwardly fear.
Right.
And so the horror genre intersects with those in any possible combination we can think of.
Let's go to the phones again. We've got Matt and Eloise. Hi, Matt.
Hi, I'm glad I can riff off of what the last guy said. Those feelings of having, you know, a fear about something really common. And like when I was a kid and I would ride in the back of the car at night, there would be these lights coming on the window. And it was kind of creepy looking. You know, you might even think you saw a face in it. Well, there's a movie that does that, and it's called Carnival of Souls. And it plays off of all of these little fears that we have. And like one of the things that also creeped me out when I was a kid was being raised up on one of those hydraulic lifts at a service station to check the underside of the car. And that happens in Carnival of Souls. And I'd have to say that the creepy movie or the spooky movie, like Carnival of Souls or Hitchcock's Rebecca, is much more watchable, it's much more interesting, and it creeps you out for a lot longer time than a jump film does.
Yeah, I have to agree with you on that one. Matt, what do you think, Kelly?
Well, Rebecca is one of my all-time favorite
Me too.
Films. Well, I think especially with Carnival of Souls is such a great film to bring up because it kind of, the idea of the face in the window and the idea of what we might like believe or not believe, there's a lot of misidentifications that we might have in our daily lives. I don't know if you've ever caught sight of yourself in a mirror in the store and not recognized it as yourself, but it's some of these things that happen in real life and they bring it into a horror film and they sort of make it this moment of you deciding whether you can trust your own senses or not. And when you have a film that's based on mood, you slowly realize that, no, you can't, you know, trust your senses, and that what you're experiencing, you are in a brand new world in a way. So the suspense genre, I mean, it's used in many different genres. Suspense is used in many different kinds of films, but when it's used well in horror, it's one of those things that really, really builds and builds.
And yeah.
It's very effective.
For sure. Thank you, Matt. Appreciate that. Nina in Menasha, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. There are two movies that, one, I'm not into slasher films. I mean, that's cool, but the gore isn't my thing. It's the suspense and the wondering. And the movie that still terrifies me to this day, and I'm like 50, is What Lies Beneath that came out in 2000 with Harrison Ford and Michelle Pfeiffer. It deals with the supernatural. That terrifies me because my whole family has witnessed stuff as a group that can't be explained. My brother lived in a haunted house. And the other, the freaky one is sort of gory, is from 1982, the Kurt Russell version of The Thing. That was terrifying.
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Nina. Kelly?
Yes, I would say The Thing is another favorite of mine. There's something about, again, not being able to know if your friends are your friends anymore and not being able to, and again, John Carpenter is really good with kind of dealing out the scares. But in that case, the special effects were used to, they're very, very effective, and they were done to such a level that in other horror films might have been like a cheap scare, but this takes the model of this alien sort of influence that we have no like grounds for understanding, and yet it is able to take the form of, you know, people you know really well, and not knowing who is who and what is what, again, it plays upon those deep, deep fears that perhaps your friend is not your friend. Perhaps this person is not who they say they are.
Yeah, that the Invasion of the Body Snatchers is similar to that too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about movies like The Sixth Sense or others? What kind of genre would you put those in?
Those are kind of, I would call it a creepy ghost supernatural. it's the hybrid, I would call it.
Okay.
But yeah, I still remember the kind of a reveal in The Others where you finally, because the whole movie goes on and it's not really explaining a lot of the points that it's kind of showing you. And then when the big reveal is done, it's one of those moments where you're like, well, of course, why didn't I think of that sooner?
Yes.
But yeah, and The Sixth Sense is another thing. I mean, the same kind of thing, the reveal actually, finally, all the pieces, the puzzle pieces go together. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I have to say my claim to fame is that I figured out The Sixth Sense like a quarter of the way through. But then I had to reveal it to the people I was with, and they were not happy with me. So,
no, of course not.
Let me do a public apology to them right now. So, Christina in Madison has a question. Go right ahead, Christina.
Hi there. I really appreciate this conversation. It's very illuminating, and I like the psychological approach. Just a second. I'm just coming in with my dog. Can you hold for just one second?
Sure. That's a new one on me. Well, let's just go to an email real quick. Troy in Lake Geneva called but couldn't stay with us. He says that there's a long history of literature being adapted into horror films. What makes a successful book to movie adaptation, in your opinion?
Oh, gosh. I think a successful adaptation is something that's not going to it's going to translate some of the extensive kind of inner thoughts that you have in writing and be able to translate that into how do we show this? And more important than that is what do we show versus what we hear? How do we deliver those same sorts of, you know, sensibilities in the through line of the book? How do we deliver that in film? And, you know, mostly when people are not a big fan of an adaptation, it's because their imagination has gone wild with the written word. And there's just a way that this needs to be translated on the screen. And so just to make sure that you kind of get those main points, and then you translate those into how the horror genre can, you know, deliver sound and image. But
do you think it's much more difficult when a novel is really well known? I mean, let's take Jaws, for instance. At the time, mm-hmm. it was huge. And then the movie comes out. It's like, how does the filmmaker take what was in the movie or the book and translate it, even though we know how it ends, sort of?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I remember I read Jaws before I ever saw that movie. And I was young, but I don't know why my parents were letting me read Jaws. But anyway.
They hadn't read it, probably. Yeah.
But I think that at the beginning of Jaws, there's a whole part where the woman whose death opens up the movie. There's a whole sort of character, you know, she has thoughts, she has feelings, there are things that she's going through, and there's a reason she goes out into the ocean. And all of that is sort of pushed aside in a movie. You just basically start with the person or the people in the water. And, you know, so you kind of, part of those things are going to be cut out. Because the tropes of the horror genre is like, well, we deliver the kind of punch that starts the narrative, and that would be the death of mm-hmm. the person who doesn't show up again, so we don't need to have that information. And that's basically, you know, cutting certain things out. And then, you know, Jaws is, by our standards today, you know, you might see that it has a slow pace in some sections. So those are the sections where you really are kind of letting the audience kind of slow down and sit with characters for a while before the action really ramps up, so that you kind of have an investment in that. So I think a filmmaker who's doing an adaptation for, you know, a screenplay or something is having to make a lot of choices and trying to figure out how the audience is going to be reading the story in general.
And some directors obviously have a better feel for it than others do. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. That is true.
Well, Christina in Madison has her dog in her house now. So go ahead, Christina. What was your question?
I am so sorry for that rudeness.
No problem. It's just unusual.
I know. I was just sort of confronted with the door and the, you know, and the wind.
Not a problem. Go right ahead.
Now, I did not get to hear. I got to hear you up to where you were approaching the 70s and beyond. And I was expecting some commentary about Halloween. The film, Halloween.
Did you have a question about it, or you just want us to talk about it?
Well, two things. One is, in general, I love the approach of looking at these films from really what scares us is the psychological aspect, right, of these films. And I love that. I love that part of the discussion. Now, as far as Halloween goes, and now it reminds me of Jaws also, are these sequels. I think that they debase the art of the original film. I mean, and I think that the people who exploit that for cash are really doing a very bad thing.
Okay. Thank you, Christina. Kelly, what do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that in the 1970s, and it's good that you mentioned Jaws, and also we have, you know, other films that are coming out in the 70s, you know, 1978 with Halloween. We've got a new model of producing things in Hollywood at that time. It goes from being a model of, you know, studios funding a lot of different kinds of projects, both A-level and B-level, so different genres, horror films. And then, you know, basically 1974, 1975, the model changes to the blockbuster model. And so they start putting more money for fewer films. And at the same time, you've got the independent film market sort of still going where, you know, it's self-funded and you know, smaller projects are being done over there. So when you have the blockbuster model, the idea is you make as much money as you can through not just ticket sales, but franchising and, you know, the toys you can bring home from the screening. If you remember, you know, Star Wars, which is not a horror film, but it's right around the same time. So Halloween is kind of an important part of the production of that time, that not only did it kind of happen at the same time as all these blockbuster things, but you have the director kind of playing upon the idea that the killer could be anywhere, could be anyone. It could, you know, they could be hidden. And again, they're the escaped mental patient angle. So I think that then when you have sequels of a movie like that, we're following the arc of a story that began way back when. So it is about making money. And when you have a franchise like Friday the 13th, where things just get crazier over time, it's one of the ways that the horror genre as a field can make money in context with the blockbuster model of filmmaking at the time. So okay. That's sort of a broad answer, but it's one of the reasons why sequels became the thing for horror.
Sure. I mean, once you get entrenched or involved in the characters too, you want to see what happens to them. And that's part of it. So let's talk about from a technical filmmaking standpoint here. What are some of the techniques that directors use to create these, you know, suspense and unease when we're watching a movie?
Yeah. So again, I'll just bring it back to what are we able to see and what are we able to hear? So when you're talking about the techniques of filmmaking, you're going to have often low lighting, or if it's well lit, you're having a restricted view given to you by the camera. Sometimes the cuts, the editing, can be more quick at some times, so that maybe you flash on something, but you don't really catch sight of it. You know, you catch something out of the corner of your eye, as you might put it, and that's all done through sort of editing. So the editing can change speeds. You can sit in one space for a while, like I talked about with the shot Jaws, but then perhaps something else happens very, very quickly, and your brain is still trying to make sense of it. And at the same time, sound is really, really important, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I am a sound person, so I really appreciate the ways that directors have offered clues, and sometimes very fleshed out clues, and also points of horror that will be just off screen or in the next room or unidentifiable from above in an empty house, you know. So and also there are things like the film called The Changeling back in the 70s. It was there are certain kinds of sounds that you would hear repeated throughout the film without knowing what was causing those sounds. And when you finally get the reveal of what's causing the sound, that is the crux of the horror of the movie. And sometimes it takes the whole movie to get there. But it's based on sound. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sound. I mean, if you've ever seen a movie, you know, saw Jaws without the music, or Psycho, going back to that again, it's just not the same, is it?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Psycho also, you brought it up, so the ubiquitous shower scene, and I like to joke with my students that I kill that actress like at least twice a semester, because I show this scene both to sound students and, you know, the visual.
Sure.
But the violins that stand in, they're shrieks, and they stand in for her screams at some point. And the music itself is kind of on a descending note, you know, do, 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 do. And you're kind of, the whole thing comes together in one moment that where screams are both sound effects and the voice, but there's no words. And then the violins are adding to that, and they're screeching. Yeah. So all of this is just a mesh of sound at that point that's going along with the image. And then at the end of that scene, you're left with just the regular old shower, you know,
yep.
kind of splashing in the tub, and it's all horrifyingly normal.
Yeah. Yeah. And what always surprises me out of that is that you do never see the knife penetrating the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all in your head. But people will say, oh, no, obviously, she, you know, but it's like, no, go back.
Yeah, that is typical Hitchcock. And that sort of thing has been used in other films as well, just where you insist you saw something and you could go back again and again. And Texas Chainsaw Massacre is another film where the title indicates a lot more, you know, bloodshed than the film actually has. But but there's a moment where you insist you see something happen, and you just don't. If you go back and look at it, that moment never happens. Nothing ever penetrates the flesh. You know?
Right. Yes. It's amazing. We've got Adam in Oshkosh.
Great.
Go ahead, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a slight twist. I just want more of your comment on it rather than it being a question. And that's finding the absurdity in horror movies, whether you go back to, I guess, Bugs Bunny or even SpongeBob now, where they make fun of ghosts and where they're not scary and they're proven to be absurd. Or I saw it last night during the World Series, the insurance commercial. In a horror movie, you make poor decisions. You know, let's hide behind those chainsaws, or even the young Frankenstein. So I just, you know, I guess you can kind of tell when that started up, or, you know, the Three Stooges meet Frankenstein. It seems to me when the black and whites in the 30s came out, probably Looney Tunes glommed onto it right away and said, here's something we can make fun of. But just wondering what your comment and what your thoughts are on that.
Great. Thanks, Adam.
Sure.
Yeah, go ahead, Kelly.
Yeah, so there's, I think, going back to my comments on we as audiences are really good at decoding horror. And when you have these moments where it is basically playing to our knowledge, they know we know that it's ghosts are scary, right? And that commercial is a really great example, but also the movie Scream, where they outwardly talk about what the rules are for watching horror. Like, you never say, or for being in a horror movie, you never say, "I'll be right back," you know, because you're not. And so the parody angle is a way for us to kind of both embrace our knowledge about a genre and kind of like laugh about our expectations. But then, using Scream as another example, the reason it sort of broke new ground in the horror genre is because it did this, and then it still subverted our expectations at the end. For Bugs Bunny and everything, that's I would say a more enjoyable, it's meant to be sort of for kids.
Yeah.
But Scream did it really well. And also Evil Dead 2, which is Bruce Campbell as Ash Williams. And that movie is really absurd. It goes way over the top. It takes our expectations and pushes it way in the realm of the campy, sort of excessive. instead of just the walls bleeding, you're going to have the walls gushing, and it's just humorous.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, and I have to say, I'm not a big fan of like the slasher movies. I saw the original Halloween back in the theater when it came out, and I thought it was hilarious that this was just so. Right. I went back and explained this to my friends, and I was just laughing the whole way. But Scream, I really have to give them so much credit, because that opening scene with Drew Barrymore is really creepy, and then bringing the humor into it, excellent. It was a really excellent, excellent film. Let's go to an email. We had Kat in Green Bay who emailed us, and she said she's not much of a horror fan, although she does love psychological thrillers. She did take a women in film class in college, and she says she'll never forget the disturbing Hitchcock quote that says, he said, "Blondes make the best victims. They're like the virgin snow that shows up the bloody footprints." And she wants to know if you have any insight into women in the horror film industry that you'd like to share with us. And that's definitely a big topic there, too.
Yeah, and thank you so much for that question. Looking for an excuse to talk about it. It's true that there are these archetypes in horror, and it's true that the blonde female virgin is one of them, and there's the black person dying first is another one. There are a lot of different kinds of tropes that have been kind of churned out by like many, many, many horror films. But then you have films that will respond to this by having a strong female character who, despite all odds, is going to survive. So the final survivor used to be called, in the literature, would be called the final girl. And it's somebody who kind of subverts the tropes that you expect. So, for example, in the slasher film, everyone knows that if you have sex, you must die. Right. And the final girl is often somebody who shows less interest in that, or doesn't have a boyfriend, or is, you know, stays home while her friends are partying. And it doesn't have to be a girl either. It's a capital G. So just the final survivor of these films. But those sorts of characters, as they've moved away from just slasher films, have become a lot more complex and a lot more, they are able to handle their trauma. And then you get also films like Babadook. Babadook is all about, you know, this woman's grief, but it's grief kind of made flesh in a way, where you have this Babadook, the ghost who comes out of this book. And, you know, her world is falling apart, but it offers a view into, this film offers a view into things like grief, motherhood, you know, subverting expectations for things like that. And you end up empathizing a lot with the woman's position in the book. You understand difficulties that women might encounter in their daily roles that other films may not necessarily kind of deal with properly. So I think these things have you know, there's opportunities anyway for people to change how these tropes are actually handled, and also the meaning of the judgments that every horror film kind of, you know, makes on its characters.
Yeah. Thank you for that email, Kat. We're talking with Kelly Kirshner. She's about scary movies. She's an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. Tell us what you like about scary movies. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email. That's talk@wpr.org. You're listening to The Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. Hope you can join us again tomorrow on Garden Talk. Aaron Presley's back to help you with growing herbs. And then at 12:30, we're going to talk about the amazing bonsai trees and how to grow them. That's tomorrow starting at 11. Right now, we are talking about scary movies to celebrate Halloween. We've got Jeff in Madison, who's got a comment about one of his favorite movies. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, hi. People haven't talked about this movie in a while. It was 1963, The Haunting, a Shirley Jackson novel made into a movie. And it was made in 63. There weren't many major films shot in black and white then, but this was. And it's one of those movies that's a very psychological haunted house movie that I've seen so many times. And I think it's just a beautiful movie. I don't know if people are familiar with it.
Okay, thank you, John. You've seen the Haunting, I'm sure, Kelly.
Yeah, The Haunting. It is a great movie. I really like that movie. And then we have more recent things on TV, Netflix. You've got The Haunting of Hill House, and you've got you know, even there was a remake of The Haunting at some point. So that notion of people being trapped inside a house and having these archetypes of characters and how these people intersect. Also, the idea of a home where you're supposed to be safe, sort of having these elements that might, you know, possess or change you from within, and, you know, rooted down to deep, deep fears about intimacy and just like safety. You know, problems with safety, and also being around strangers, you know. So that film, if you haven't seen it, I recommend to all our viewers to see that. It is a great film.
And Shirley Jackson certainly came up with some good, things for movies for sure. But she was really good at taking the normal and making it scary.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kimberly near Madison, what comment do you have?
Hi, all this talk about scary movies, I wanted to talk a little bit about the Wendigo. And the Wendigo is an entity or a being largely in the North Woods or the North Country of North America. And it possesses, it's a folklore kind of being that possesses human beings. And it uses human beings as a vessel to impose harm and haste and speed and greed. And it takes over human beings. And so you don't necessarily know they're scary or know they're a threat, but they do impose harm and they are very, very vicious. Although they look like your neighbors, your friends, you know, your family. And so it's kind of that get out kind of horror element where human beings are infected, and then they are used to deploy harm because the Wendigo is kind of the spirit that consumes them and corrupts them. And so many nonfiction films, documentaries, horror films, and fictional films have been based on that concept of kind of the human beings as vessels for harm and scariness and horror. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if there was a film that's ever used the Wendigo in the film, or as a historian or a cinephile, if you know if that being has ever been used in cinema.
Okay, thanks, Kimberly. Kelly, are you aware of it?
I think there is a movie called The Wendigo.
I think you're right. And I know I've seen TV shows about that too.
Yeah. I think what's interesting, first of all, to one of your points, is that it is true that one of the biggest deep-seated fears that we have is somehow losing what makes us us, which is like losing your identity or being pushed down, you know, to be in somebody else's control or being trapped inside your body and not being able to communicate. These are all like deep-seated fears that that play with our very notions of being human or being, you know, individuals. And also the other thing is that with the Wendigo and the other sorts of folkloric creatures, you have that old style way of living in the world where you are more connected with nature. You're more connected with like the mythologies that used to explain the world around us before, say, science came in and, you know, kind of put labels on things. So this is a way of living in the world where the Wendigo can exist. And those fears, or, you know, during your dreams, during your sleep, you could, you know, breathe the wrong air and have something invade you. All of those kinds of things have come out in literature, but they also are kind of part of our experience of the world, in a way. There are things that happen that we can't explain. You know, we can't explain if we see something out of the corner of our eye, but we know the cat wasn't there or something like that. And so the Wendigo is a way for us to kind of rehearse these really older methods of living in the world, but it also is a deep-seated fear of losing control.
Thank you, Kimberly. Appreciate that. Kelly, there's a lot of horror movies that have been out there. I'm thinking in the, like, maybe the Indominus syndrome, or things about like pandemics and things that could happen in real life. How do you think that affected how people reacted when we went through the latest pandemic?
Well, I think that's a great question, because I think I would say the same is true for horror and science fiction. A role that these play in how we might respond. So when we're watching science fiction, we're watching a hypothetical situation and we're watching how the characters respond to this. We take our cues from them. And in horror, we're kind of watching this rehearsal of our deepest fears. And we know when somebody is, a character is doing something dumb on screen, you know, or we know that they're going to trip, you know.
Yes.
But yeah, but I mean, it is, one of those, it's just one of those things that we're always watching for, right?
Oh, yeah. For sure. You know, in the last minute or so that we've got here, what are some of the new horror movies that you're seeing now? How is the genre changing in today's mm-hmm. world?
Well, I think when you say newer, I'm going to go back to 2015 and say The Witch and Get Out were two, and Get Out like later than 2015. Those two films kind of complicate our ideas of how horror can be connected to hereditary sort of like the things that we inherit from generational trauma mm-hmm. or the things we inherit from culture. And I think these, you know, while Get Out is being produced, we have Black Lives Matter movement. We have a lot of other things that are happening where it's a way for us to work out kind of these ideas of the approach to gender and race that are changing, and the ways that we can kind of identify with the characters and their horror, and we can really see how it's connected to history. And I think that's an important part. A final like film that I really like from more recently is called Hellbender. And that film has very little in the way of sort of horror or jump scares. But when you get to the end, it's the kind of contemporary witch story that that connects the idea of witches not to, you know, standing around a fire and chanting, but witches who have a connection to nature and who are trying to kind of battle against their generational inheritance or, you know, or its inevitability, mm-hmm. I would say. So if you haven't seen Hellbender, I like that one.
Okay. Well, thank you for the recommendation. What are you doing tonight to celebrate Halloween?
If there's no other haunted proms to go to, I'll do something.
Okay. Well, thank you, Kelly, so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Kelly Kirshner. She is an artist, filmmaker, sound designer, writer, and educator. Thanks to our team for helping to create our shows, Clara Neipert, Joel Pattenaud, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Roberts. I am executive producer Jill Nadeau, and of course, Larry Mueller is our normal host. You have a spooky Halloween.